from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza, until the last battle, were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabab Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, will continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Homolezki, Vienna.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalising the misery of you know, people who are extremely marginalised, excluded, and many of which have, you know, travelled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainment and deportation. Richard Sudan, London.
As anti-racism activists, Black Lives Matter demonstrators and U.S. officials mark the killing of George Floyd with memorial events and marches around the country, the members of the victim's family met with President Joe Biden. In New York, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton and several other officials, including the city's mayor Bill de Blasio, gathered and kneeled in a symbolic move to remember the black man's murder.
As we want to dramatize to the world the insensitivity and outright total lack of any concern that this officer had, he put his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you've got to have a lot of disregard for the law, disregard for a human being, to have something throbbing under you that long.
During the memorial, de Blasio slammed the persistent U.S. police brutality and racism.
How do you forget someone's humanity? Well, because for 400 years in this country, the persistent, obsessive training was to tell white people not to value black lives. It was everywhere you turned. And it poisoned the memory to that officer. What he did disgusts me to this hour of this day.
More than 150 years after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the U.S., opinion polls show most American adults believe the legacy of slavery continues to have an impact on the position of black people in society. Following the murder of Floyd, Americans and people around the world ramped up calls to root out law enforcement misconduct and violence against black people. After a year, the divided U.S. Congress still struggles to find a compromise to pass a federal bill in response to the ongoing controversial methods of policing. The 46-year-old Floyd was killed in Minneapolis by white former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted last month of murder. While the conviction of Chauvin, who faces up to 40 years in prison, marked a new chapter in the U.S., incidents of similar nature have nevertheless persisted in the country ever since. A year after the brutal murder, activists say measures taken by some jurisdictions, which have been on the books for years, are insufficient to address the issue of systematic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Yemeni people and government officials headed to Hamas office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to extend their congratulations to Palestinians for their historic victory over the Israeli regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians against any new Israeli aggression.
We in the Hamas movement live here among our Yemeni brothers who share with us the joy of victory, and this is something expected from the Yemeni people. This victory was achieved thanks to God and thanks to the efforts of the brothers in the resistance axis, including Yemenis. We share the same goal and vision with the Yemeni people who made the issue of Palestine one of their top priorities despite being involved in a deadly war by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The Yemenis called on the Palestinian resistance to continue its armed struggle against Israel. They also thanked Iran for its open support for Palestinians' resistance groups.
We came here to congratulate our Palestinian brothers on this great victory that delighted the Yemenis and all the free people of the world. This victory was clinched with the blessing of God and the great support of Iran, and it was a confirmation of our unified stance against our common enemy Israel, who was defeated in this battle. The resistance groups must continue their armed struggle until the liberation of all occupied lands.
Israel killed hundreds of civilians, including women and children, in its war on Gaza and its deadly crackdown on Palestinians on the occupied West Bank earlier this month. Palestinian resistance groups responded by hitting the Israeli-occupied territories with hundreds of rockets, which forced the regime to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
Yemenis say the ongoing Saudi war on their country told them that arms struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They believe that Palestinians are on the right path to regaining their territories from the Israeli occupation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories as a fragile ceasefire halts in the besieged Gaza Strip following an 11-day Israeli airstrikes on the enclave. Tens of Palestinians were detained by Israeli forces in raids across the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Club Association expects more arrests to be reported within the coming days.
Israel's occupation project has not ended yet. These arrests are aimed at draining the energy of the Palestinian people who are determined to resist Israel. The Israeli authorities think that by adopting aggressive measures, they can refrain the consciousness of the Palestinian people.
Over the past days, Israeli forces have arrested hundreds of Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948. Moreover, the Israeli police announced it arrested 1,550 Palestinians in the past 2 weeks in areas such Haifa, Yaffa, Lod, Ramli, and Kfar Kanna, towns in occupied lands amid tension over Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. These areas have witnessed the protests against Israeli aggression on Palestinians in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. These protests have been attacked by both the Israeli police and settlers, and many of the Palestinians' shops and vehicles have been smashed.
Israel tries to oppress the Palestinians through arresting them so that they can't remain united in their resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Tension escalated across the Palestinian territories since last month over Israel's attempt to ethnically cleanse Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds from Palestinian families in favor of settlement groups. The situation flared up after Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque and assaulted worshippers inside. Observers say Israel has declared war against Palestinians because they have dared to resist its colonial projects and demand freedom. However, amid its failure to silence the Palestinians during its aggression against Gaza, Israel escalates mass arrests, thinking it might bring them to their knees. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The war of words between former top aide Dominic Cummings and the British Prime Minister has intensified. In a volley of tweets on the weekend, Cummings described Britain's early plan to combat the coronavirus pandemic as a disaster. Perhaps the most contentious of his allegations, the Johnson government's initial official strategy in March last year to achieve herd immunity without a vaccine. In other words, to let the virus rip through the population in order for people to build natural immunity, an allegation the government denies.
And you now admit as government that herd immunity was the policy until March?
Not at all, no. Absolutely not. Our policy, so, from the outset, Andrew, the policy and the strategy...
So why is Dominic Cummings telling us that that's true?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Cummings.
When he was fired last year, Cummings took a large amount of documents with him, allegedly proving his allegations. He will appear in the British Parliament on May 26, where he is expected to present what he has called crucial historical evidence.
But Dominic Cummings to come out now and say he doesn't... He weaves this as a word that that was a word of rubbish and it was dangerous... begs the question, why didn't he say that now, when he was in a position advising the government?
But why has Cummings, who played an important role in Boris Johnson's successful 2019 election campaign and was also the architect of Britain's campaign to leave the European Union, lashing out at his former boss?
He feels extremely sore, having been sacked from his position as Boris Johnson's chief advisor. So I think there's a question of personal revenge does come into it. But how far does he really want to push this? Does he want to push it to is in danger of toppling Boris Johnson? I suspect not.
Three lockdowns, more than 128,000 deaths, and a deep economic slump since the start of the pandemic. The British Prime Minister has hailed his government's vaccination program as a success. The question now is whether that parliamentary committee put Boris Johnson's security of tenure ahead of his responsibility for allowing the COVID-19 outbreak to soar in communities across the UK in the spring and summer of last year. Saeed Puriza, London.
Public outpouring against Israel in Pakistan. The streets of the mega city of Karachi flooded with protesters in solidarity with Palestinians. There is no let-up to anti-Israel protest in this 220 million populated Muslim country after Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest site in the eastern Jerusalem al-Quds and imposed a unilateral war on Gaza. The huge collateral and human losses in the latest round of one-sided war imposed on unarmed Palestinians has once again become a rallying point to unify people from all segments of the society in Pakistan to join hands to protest against Israel.
We thank to Allah. Today people in every Muslim country stand by Palestinians. And by God willing, we would continue our war against Israel until we liberate Al-Quds Mosque.
The anti-Israel protests have been swelling in Pakistan despite a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas administration in Gaza. Pakistan's government is feeling the heat of public pressure, which is reflected in country's foreign minister's rare and blunt remarks about Western media outlets on how they have been whitewashing war crimes of Israel against Palestinians.
Israel is losing out. They're losing the media war despite their connections. They are losing the media war. The tide is turning.
What are their connections?
Deep pockets.
What does that mean?
Well, they're very influential people. I mean, they control media.
I would call that an anti-Semitic remark.
Pakistan has rejected criticism of pro-Israeli lobbies and Western media, claiming that country's foreign minister's remarks were anti-Semitic. On the contrary, foreign minister's analogy about nexus between Israel and Western media has been welcomed across the Muslim world. Islamabad says the Western media has been covering up the massacre of Palestinians by propagating it as Israel's right of self-defense. On the other hand, whenever leaders of the Muslim countries speak truth about Israel's aggression and apartheid state's overgrown influence on Western media to whitewash its war crimes, they call it anti-Semitic. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Debate. Hello and warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The French president has recognized his country's role in the Rwandan genocide while leaving a wreath on a mass grave of the victims. Emmanuel Macron is set to try to reset French relations with Rwanda after years of accusations of French complicity in the 1994 atrocities. A March report by a French inquiry said that colonial attitude had blinded French officials, whose country bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the slaughter. And tonight's debate show will briefly review the history of French colonialism. Stay tuned.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then-Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries.
From 1990 to 1995, French decision-makers decided to maintain Rwanda in the country's zone of influence. They decided to arm the regime and to support the Hutu extremists against Tutsis before, during, and even after the genocide. The French authorities had been perfectly informed on the issue.
The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide commissioned by Macron in 2019 said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Let's now see who we have to join us on this tonight's debate show with some insight and contribution. We'll have independent writer and activist Dale T. McKinley in Johannesburg, and academic political commentator Mustafa Taraore, who's joining us from Paris. Good to have you both, gentlemen, on the show. Let's go to Dale. An NGO argues that France is complicit in the Rwanda genocide because it provided weapons to rebels, it also facilitated genocide, and also provided shelter to those who committed atrocity after the event. How would you judge the issue?
Well, it's very clear, I think, to anybody who was paying attention at the time, and obviously since then, and all of the different reports that have been done, is that there is absolutely French influence. French, as the ex-colonial power predominantly in that region, bear a distinct responsibility for what happened, for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of arming, but more so because I think the French presence indicates a much more, I think, deeper colonial mentality when it comes, whether it's Rwanda or any other of the ex-colonies that France had power over, which is that it's a very patronizing kind of relationship, and whatever suits the French, that's what they'll do. So when it was the Hutu regime, and when they were carrying out the atrocities, and when the genocide began, and it was very clear, the French turned a blind eye because it was in their interest to do so. And the same would go for many places in West Africa and otherwise. This is consistent with a colonial mentality that not only the French, but the British, the Portuguese, and many of the ex-colonial powers in Africa have always had and continue to have to this day. So while it's good that there is a degree of recognition and a degree of responsibility being taken, I would definitely agree with the Rwandan genocide survivors that it does not go far enough.
Okay. Now, Mustafa, a French inquiry has absolved France of direct complicity in the killing of 800,000 Tutsis, something that Macron avoided mentioning in his speech at the genocide memorial. Is France not complicit in the genocide?
I think France is complicit in the genocide. When you know that genocide is going to take place and you provide these people who want to commit the genocide with weapons and shelter after, it means that you take part in a genocide. So it's not just complicit. It is even taking part in the genocide. Mm-hmm. So France took part in the genocide, and France is not ready to clearly apologize. So it is the first step, what happened today with Macron, but this is not enough. And there's something I'm very concerned with, is normally when we speak of a genocide, there's a reparation. So this is what generally what happens whenever you've got the question of a genocide. So now we will see if something is going to come after the recognition of the responsibility of France. Mm-hmm. What is the next step? Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of reparation? That's my first point. My second point is this one. What is to blame here is the French colonial attitude. What was done since 1994 to get rid of this French attitude? Because we know that this is a French know-how.
Right.
Okay. Where they educated? Are the French educated about it, about genocide and how to behave and how to deal with African continents? Has things changed? I'm not sure.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, Dale, what makes Macron fail to make an open apology for the Rwandan bloodbath?
Well, like all good politicians, generally Macron, he covers all of his bases. So when any country, particularly a European superpower such as France and an ex-colonial power, comes into the African continent and in this case tries to sort of patch things up with Rwanda in this case, what's a consideration for Macron is domestic politics, how it looks at home. There are upcoming French elections next year. Macron comes from a center-right ideological position, which has fairly close ties with the French military, and also was a fairly accepting of the French colonial adventures, and also then what we've called neo-colonial adventures in the last 20 or 30 years in West Africa and other places of influence. So there are domestic issues at play where he needs to shore up his own support. He won't go too far. That's why he didn't issue an apology. But he needs to make it appear as though at least he is sincere and they want to mend relations, precisely because I think Macron also wants to be a player on the world stage. So in this way, he looks diplomatic. He covers his domestic policy bases, but he also repairs certain relations in Africa and makes France look better. So in that case, he's being the quintessential politician.
Mustafa, France has a dark history of colonialism in Africa, as you know, especially Algeria and the War of Independence, where the government said that more than 1 million people lost their lives. Let's have your take on that.
Yes, I think it is not just part of history. It is happening even now. If you look at the situation in Mali, 2 days ago, we had a coup d'etat. And the reason why is because France was involved in it, because France wants to split Mali, okay? And so which means that they had corrupt the leaders of the president of Mali and the prime minister. Okay, so who is providing the terrorists with weapons in the north of Mali, in a zone where the Malian army is not allowed, but the French army is allowed? Okay. So this is another question. So I think that this is it's not just part of history. It has always been the case. The only time France failed was with the Algerian War in 1962. So it's very important that we think about this one and we remember it. It's not just the French government that is responsible. The French population is partly responsible because it is something they prefer to ignore. We all know that France is in debt. If you look at the debt, the French debt, taking into account the French GDP, it is the most important debt in Europe. Where is France going to get its money? In Africa. So this is why what happened with Rwanda, I see it as just an odd trick. It is just a trick. France needs Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of what they have to do is a fair kind of apology regarding what happened. But we know that what they did, they are doing it again. They are still doing it, and they were not taught how to do things differently.
Now, Dale, is France's half-hearted admission of responsibility a new strategy for reviving the influence that it's lost in Africa?
Well, I think that Macron, as I said, Macron has, since he came to be the president of France, has wanted to play the world stage. He's wanted to sort of, I think, reassert French influence. And where best to do that, where better to do that than in Africa, the former colonial playground, where there are, you know, economic ties, there's cultural ties, linguistic ties, and other kinds of things. So, yes, places and like France, in places like France, which are in, as the other commentator was saying, in economic difficulties, particularly now, France and others, they search outward for influence, for new forms of accumulation, for new ways of making influence. And Macron sees, I think, West Africa and Central Africa as the place to do that. Everybody knows that the key in Africa in terms of economically is its natural resources. It always has been. Mm-hmm. And the colonial powers have tried to maintain influence on this front in order to have that pipeline of natural resources, but also geostrategic influences. So what has gone on in North Africa over the last 20 years, in Libya, in Morocco, in Tunisia, Mali, Mauritania, all over the place, and then, of course, back in even Nigeria and across the Horn of Africa. If the French can play that kind of role as a mediator and then also as an offensive military force to deal with terrorist influences and other kinds of things, then it can project that power on a world stage. And I think Macron wants to do that. You can tell that this is exactly what he wants to do. At the same time, there are fundamentally, as we started this conversation, at the heart of that are the self-interests, the interests of France themselves and the ruling class in France, which has huge economic ties, which has a lot invested in Africa. And in that case, there are very specific economic reasons for this kind of recalibrating and re-strategizing kind of role. As the world itself becomes more sort of unpredictable and things become a little bit less certain, countries like France are going to move into these gaps that they can find to reassert themselves both politically, economically, and militarily.
Okay, interesting analysis. Mustafa, as you may recall, the French Air Force played a leading role in Libya that helped topple longtime ruler there, Muammar Gaddafi. Tell us about this French intervention and what France was doing there in Libya.
Yes, we all know the reason why Gaddafi was assassinated. He was assassinated by the French directly. And the reason why is because he had some projects for the African continent. He wanted to work towards the independence, the real independence of all African nations in terms of currency, technology, communication. And this is the main reason why he was assassinated. It's not just me saying it. Okay? You got lots of well-documented reports on it. attacking. So this is why, and of course, because they control the media, they made us believe that Gaddafi was about to massacre his population, as if he was a crazy man. I'm not saying that Gaddafi was perfect, but we knew what was going to happen. Many African countries, Mali included, spoke and said that it was very dangerous to get rid of Gaddafi, that it was going to destabilize the region. They were not listened to. How can you go to a continent and not listen to people from that continent when they warn you about what is going to happen? What is the situation today in Libya? Libyans, you used to see them very often in the UK, going to the university and going back to Libya, not even immigrating to Western Europe. Now, you've got lots of them in Paris begging. What is that? If you look at the statistics, if you look at the economy, how strong the economy was in Libya, it was maybe one of the most of the best economies in the African continent, with South Africa and Algeria. What is the situation today? Can you go and say that you are going to be educated in Libya? Where are the universities? Are the people learning? No. What they are just doing now, they are just exploiting the oil. And with that came the problem we have now in Mali. They just promised to a minority group a kind of independence. That is not possible. We Africans are not defined by countries. Countries got no meaning to us. Ethnicity, yes, but one nation is composed of different ethnic groups. There's nothing like mono-ethnic, mono-religious. No, we are all composed of different people, and this is the strength of Africa. You can be from the north, you can be Pulan, you can be Tuareg, you can be Mandingo. We are all Malians. There's no distinction. Different cultures, different languages, different ethnic groups in one nation. And this is real tolerance, democracy, and this is what the United States is trying to do. All the nations saying that, okay, we are going to work towards multiculturalism and all these things. We have it in Africa. We don't have to look at what's happening in the United States to learn about multiculturalism or in the UK. We have it in Africa.
Okay. Now, Dale, on the heels of a French involvement in Libya, then we had the unilateral intervention in Mali in 2013 that seemed to confirm Paris's willingness to be forceful on the world stage, while at the same time it took a backseat in the Middle East and even objected to the US-led invasion of Iraq. Let's have your take on that.
Well, when countries such as France, powers such as France sitting on the UN Security Council, like the others there, when they play on the geostrategic terrain of the world, it's always going to be contradictory because different places are with different interests. So, for example, let's take the Middle East, where France and many of the European countries were against the U.S. Actions in Iraq and saying, no, we should pull out, and they should pull out and shouldn't have such a militarized state of things, while at the same time, as you mentioned, they're militarizing West Africa in exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. So it all depends on what interest, economic, what political, and what geostrategic interests are playing themselves out in different parts of the world. The United States does this all the time. So on one side, they'll be very, very critical of China and their human rights record. And then when it comes to, for example, let's say another country in South America or in Africa, which is just as authoritarian or even much worse than the Chinese, they'll keep quiet because it's in their geostrategic or in their economic interests. or because they need an ally for particular reasons, other politically, to play themselves out. The French played this game very well in the area, in the neighborhood. So it's not surprising. French are not alone in this, but in the context of wanting to, how should I say, be heard, and be heard by different voices on the international stage, what the French have done, the contradictory stances they've taken in West Africa versus the Middle East or somewhere else, are consistent with a particular foreign policy that is contradictory in itself, because that contradiction has no principle necessarily. It's not a principle of solidarity. It's not a principle of assistance. It's a principle of self-interest. And self-interest changes according to what is at play.
Okay,
so I have to
jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time that we have had. Let me thank our guests. We had independent writer and activist Dale T. McKinley from Johannesburg, and academic and political commentator Mustafa Tarawre in Paris. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests the connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Matteo Rozza Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Climate Crisis May Lead to Rising Stillbirths. Stay tuned for more. Climate change is perhaps the greatest existential threat that humanity has ever faced. And as environmental research accumulates, we keep discovering unexpected side effects of making industrial civilization reliant on fossil fuels. The latest one, a likely link between global warming and increased numbers of stillbirths. A new study published in the scientific journal Environmental Research suggests a connection between an increase in the Earth's temperature and more stillbirths. Authors from the University of Queensland found that pregnant women who were exposed to extreme ambient temperatures during their pregnancy seem to be at an increased risk of stillbirth, especially later in the pregnancy. Scholars at their School of Earth and Environmental Science and Mater Research Institute reviewed 12 studies with relevant data in their study. An estimated 17 to 19% of stillbirths are potentially attributable to chronic exposure to extreme hot and cold temperatures during pregnancy, the authors note. Climate change can have a multitude of impacts on an individual's health, especially among vulnerable populations, the research team behind the study told reporters by mail. For pregnant mothers, extreme weather events can impact access to antenatal services and increased risk of heat-related illnesses. Mothers living in low-resource settings are particularly vulnerable to these effects. In a press release regarding the study, environmental scientist Dr. Scott Lisk described how their conclusions suggest that marginalized populations, which already struggle disproportionately due to lack of resources, will be even harder hit as global temperatures rise and they suffer more miscarriages. More than 2 million stillbirths occur every year around the world, with the most occurring in low-resource settings, Dr. Lisk said in a press release. Not only are these poorer countries already affected disproportionately by stillbirths, they are now going to be disproportionately affected by climate change as well. If the link apparent in this research bears out upon further scrutiny, the majority of new stillbirths will occur invariably in the nations already suffering the most. The scholars emphasize that much additional work needs to be done to fully understand the science at play here. To fully understand the effects of maternal exposure to ambient temperatures and stillbirth, future studies should focus on the biological mechanisms involved and contributing factors in addition to improving measurement of ambient temperature exposure. Professor Vicky Felnati, director of the Center of Research Excellence in Stillbirth, CRE, at Mater Research, said in the press release. In the meantime, we would encourage pregnant women to talk to their healthcare providers about staying safe during the cold days of winter and hot days of summer. The research team told reporters that they are interested in learning more about the ways our environment impacts stillbirth risks and chose to study ambient temperature exposure during pregnancy as an initial step. The NHMRC Stillbirth CRE research program addresses priorities across four major program areas, including improving stillbirth data to drive change, identifying new approaches to stillbirth prevention, they wrote to reporters. This review helped us to identify an important gap in data as well as highlighting a potential area where stillbirth risk could be improved in the future. The possible rise in a stillbirth is only the latest in a series of red flags indicating that pollution and greenhouse gas emissions are making Earth less habitable. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the population sizes of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish have fallen by 68% since 1970, amounting to an unprecedented decline in Earth's biodiversity. Over the last two centuries, humans have destroyed one-third of the planet's forest cover and overfished one-third of the world's fish stocks. We also continue to churn out plastic products that clog up our oceans, clutter up our land, and contain chemicals that have been linked to ominously declining sperm counts.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.